Access number 27068, Mr. George Wolfe, Reel 4. Now, we were talking about when you were in the Atlas Mountains at this this airfield attached with your unit to a US squadron. You don't know which one, I presume. No. You described before we really looked at what you were doing, how you got cut off. Now, from my impression was that you'd been cut off, but you didn't almost know you were cut off.
That's right.
That the Germans had just gone round you, but not through you.
That's right.
Could you describe what happened?
Because we were in the mountains, and the aerodrome was evacuated, but didn't let us know. We also had a landline to the aerodrome, which the local Arabs kindly cut, so that we didn't know that they had gone until early in the morning.
Were you in your billets then?
We were in tents.
In tents, so yeah. Nearby.
Nearby, about 10 miles, I should think, roughly. Away the aerodromes. We were up top in the mountains somewhere.
So you'd drive down to the airfield every day, would you?
No, we didn't.
No,
we
that's where. That's where your station was. Your wireless station.
No, our wireless station we had in mobile trucks.
And that's where you were up in.
We're up in the mountains. We had no physical contact with the aerodrome itself.
I hadn't understood that.
Yeah,
right.
Except by telephone, you know.
Well, I'm sorry, before we go on to it, can you describe the mobile trucks? What equipment did you have in the mobile?
Well, we had one very specialised trucks with either two or three of the sets fitted into them, which were fixed. They couldn't be moved. They weren't mobile. They were absolutely fixed. And then you had a couple of steps, a little ladder, leading into the truck, because that was about that high off the ground.
About 3 foot?
2-3 foot off the ground. About 3 foot, I should think. So about three steps, something like that. And it was practically a room, really. The truck was like a room with two sets fitted into some chairs, and that was it, really, and electric light in it, and of course current for the sets, and that was it, really. There were just and then we had a couple of trucks who carried all the our belongings, our gear, the tents and everything, and we had a 1500 weight which we used as a truck to move backwards and forwards to pick up rations and things from the local army unit. And eventually,
so you were up in the mountains because reception would be better
yeah,
up there.
Absolutely.
And then when you got the messages, you would wireless the airfield.
Yeah.
So no one would go down to it. You had no actual
contact with the airfield. No.
Right. So let's take what happened. So they go.
We were left, and suddenly realized that everybody packed up and gone. And so we realized that the Germans must be about. So we avoided the main roads and took us nearly 3 days through the mountain passes and that to get back to our own lot. But, and here is a little interlude, which I think is of some interest, we were resting the next night in a wood on our journey. And it had been snowing, it was very cold out there. We were lying in our greatcoats on the ground with our tin hats under our head as pillows. And we were sort of trying to get some sleep. And suddenly, I felt a torch shining in my face. And I heard some babbling going on. And we all sort of suddenly roused ourselves. And we found that a patrol of French Foreign Legion troops had stumbled on us, who then proceeded to tell us that they nearly all killed us because they didn't realize we were British until they shone their torches and found that the difference in uniform. They were expecting Germans up there. So we were very fortunate to get away with it. And then we had a
They were
French Foreign Legion under Free French command. They were fighting the Germans, yes.
And now, what was this journey like? I mean,
it was terrible. I mean, you know, some of the trucks, when we got onto these sort of mountain slopes, they were leaning over about 40, 50 degrees, you know. I mean, it was perilous, I must admit. But as I said, once these French foreign legionnaires, they put us on our way, and they said they'd sort of go after the Germans, and we were pretty clear in the area. And they also showed us that what they were eating, corned beef, dated 1917. And we showed our gratitude by dishing out a few goodies to them, like cigarettes and a few sweets and one thing and another. So we parted good friends and we were on our way. Now, before we joined our own people, I came across the most terrible sight I think I saw all through the war, and that was an American tank, a Sherman, that had tried to cross a narrow bridge across a dried out river bed and either misjudged the width or the bridge didn't hold, and it tipped over into the river bed, and the crew, the corpses, were lying at the bottom of that river bed in a terrible mangled condition. And a sight I shall never forget, but that really was the most terrible sight I had all through the campaign. And then, as I say, we managed to get back to our own people, and we then went to Tunis, and I was very relieved to get there, and it was a lovely, lovely city, I must admit, with wide boulevards and just like, almost you could say Paris in North Africa. We were stationed then in a little villa at the seaside in a little place called La Marsa. That's Lamarsa. It's quite a well-known resort actually now, Hammamet and La Marsa. And beautiful villa we took over from some French people who departed. And we could step out onto the beach through the garden doors. It was very, very nice. But we also set up, obviously, our trucks in the grounds and did our normal watches. Because at that time, it was about the time when the Germans were trying to evacuate their forces from Tunis, and I remember one early morning it was, I picked up on the wireless set a whole group of Junkers 52s who came from Sicily in order to evacuate some of Rommel's Africa Corps, and I scrambled some of our aircraft, and they apparently had a very successful day's hunting. I don't quite know how many aircraft they shot down, but it was a lot. And my CO, who had nothing to do with it, got a medal for it. I don't know, I forgot Flight Lieutenant Bill Turner. He got a gong for it. And
so that was quite an achievement.
That was quite an achievement, yes. I'm quite proud of that, actually.
Bill Turner, is it? What was he like? I mean, what was he like as an officer?
He was impossible. I mean, he was a nice man, but unfortunately, I believe, so the thing goes, that his wife at home had left him for another man, and he became an alcoholic. And he woke up in the morning drinking whiskey, and he drank it practically the whole day. But the unfortunate part was that his sidearm, his revolver, he used to, when he got a bit tight, used to flash a belt and threaten people with it. And he never shot any of us, but, you know, it was dangerous.
It was in his hand.
That was in his hand. And we then calmed him and took the revolver out of his hand until he got sober again, which was very rare. Now, then... And as I say, he got the gong. And then what was the next thing?
Was he able to perform at all as an officer?
Well, he was, but he had a nice way with him when he was sober, or even semi-sober. He was an easygoing man. I mean, he didn't act as a commanding officer, really. He was one of the lads, and, you know. As a matter of fact, I remember on one little excursion, we went to Gibraltar to pick up some convoy order which we were protecting, and there was one hotel, the Rock Hotel, I remember, where officers only were allowed, but he didn't fancy drinking on his own, so he said to me, "George, I want you to come to the Rock with me." And I said, "No way, it's the officers only." He said, "I've got a spare tunic, a spare hat, and you're going to wear that." And I did, and luckily enough, we didn't get caught, but that was by the way. And I passed as a flight lieutenant that night.
You were at La Masa.
Yeah.
Now, how did things go there? It sounds like a pretty idyllic
That
spot.
Was idyllic, and I'll tell you why, particularly. Once I'd done, let's say, if I was on night, I'd done my white night shift, I hitched or drove myself into Tunis. We had a jeep by that time, which we got off the Americans with a couple of bottles of whiskies, I think. And but I think I hitched a lift. And I was standing, I remember the day, I was standing in front of a magnificent synagogue in Tunis. And I admired the building. And a little boy sidled up to me and said, I don't know whether it was French or English now, I can't remember, one or the other. I was happy with both. He said, "Are you Jewish?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, my family want a Jewish British serviceman to join us for dinner tonight. It's the first day of Passover, first night of Passover. And would you be prepared to come?" I said, "I'll be delighted." And I went, and I made friends with those. It was a doctor, a French doctor's family who'd immigrated to Tunisia, probably to have a good practice or something. They were lovely people. And after that, we were good friends. And whenever I came off duty, I spent my time with them at their place. They had a beautiful flat, and they looked after me like their own son. And I mean that. When I was tired, I had a bed, I had a room. They brought me meals, and I used to go to the cinema with them once or twice. I mean, we corresponded for a little while after the war, but we promised. They had a daughter, she was about 19, and we promised that we would meet in Paris on the 14th of July after the war. But it never came off, obviously. And then 2 or 3 years afterwards, it gradually faded out. Like these things I love to do. But I never forget the people. They were marvellous.
Now, what about the shift system? I mean, how long were the shifts?
Well, the shifts were 8 hours on and 8 hours off. And occasionally, we tried to help one another, put an extra couple of hours on, and then somebody else did an extra couple of hours for you if there was any special reason for it. But normally there were eight on and eight off.
And was it difficult to concentrate for that length of time?
Not really. You always had a full day off once a week so that you could sort of recuperate. And it was difficult when there wasn't anything really on. That was the difficult time when you could get very bored and probably, especially in the middle of the night, you could feel quite sleepy. But then you usually had a few cups of tea and a chat with a colleague with you and pass the time somehow. But it could get quite boring at times. But then, of course, once you picked up traffic, you were fully awake pretty quickly.
Now, how much German wireless traffic was there? I mean, generally, at this stage?
Well, at this stage, there was a fair amount about, mainly when it came to attacking convoys coming along the Algerian Tunisian coast to land replacements, material. And
now, how would you find that traffic? I mean, how would you know where to look?
Well, the thing is, obviously, I mean, they change their frequencies like any Air Force does, very frequently.
Now, how often
but
is that?
But you knew there was a narrow band on which they could operate, and you knew that within that narrow band, you would find it by searching.
How often would they change? I mean, what, daily?
Probably monthly? Daily. I should think they change daily.
And would you be able to recognise when you'd found them?
Yeah. Yes, you
how?
Would.
Just by their voices? Or
by their voices, by the way the leader operated, you could more or less tell. And also, if you knew the various German accents, you know, I mean, like here, you could recognize a Scottish accent from a Welsh accent, and it was the same there. The regional accents are even more pronounced in Germany, and you know, once you got those sorted out, you knew roughly who was who, especially the squadron commanders, which was the most important thing.
So you'd basically look within a small band on the radio,
yeah,
moving the dial slowly.
Very slowly, yes, because the frequencies were so narrow that you could miss them quite easily. I mean, you had to be very, very patient and very, very careful how you used your instrument.
But you would not. Would you normally find something, or
you normally would find something? I mean, even if it was. As I said, it had to be within range. I mean, your range was pretty limited. So, I mean, towards the end of the campaign, there wasn't all that much traffic anymore.
So what was your range?
The range was about 30 miles, roughly. That was all. And that's why we always had to pick out our positions very carefully, where we situated the vehicles.
What did you look for in a position? I mean, I can understand the mountains. You get better reception, I suppose, up there. But what else did you look for in selecting a position?
No, it's mainly a height. And then, of course, a plateau where you could park your vehicles. Obviously, we couldn't sit on a peak sort of thing. You know, it had to be a plateau. If you were in the mountains, where you had to...
But on this occasion, you were by the sea, but that was...
That was by the sea, and that was mainly to pick up naval traffic.
Now, what would you do when you got this? Take me through the when you got naval traffic.
Well, you know, I mean, if ships were being attacked, you could tell from the Air Force in the air that they were attacking a convoy and sorting out certain ships. You know, I mean, that was pretty easy. I mean, I had a spell, which I don't know exactly where it fits in during the time, where I had to dash up the Algerian coast about 100 miles each way from between Algiers and Tunis two or three times a month while these convoys were coming through in order to pick up any traffic where German aircraft were liable to attack.
So how did you do that? I mean, what were you on?
We had one of our smaller vehicles, which was fitted, and with one driver and just one operator, myself.
And so you just drove up and down the coast?
Drove up and down the coast, went out about 30, 40 miles one side of Algiers, and we knew when the convoys were due to come through, and then when they were out of range, chased back, and while we were chasing back, I was sort of singing to the driver, trying to keep him awake, and when I was driving, he was singing to me, trying to keep me awake.
Now, what would you... What would you do when you got a message and it was the Navy? Did you know who to send it into, or would you just send it back to your headquarters?
You would just send it back to the headquarters, yes.
And they'd tell the Navy?
They'll inform the Navy.
And did you say you were driving there? Had you learned to drive?
Yes.
When did you learn to drive?
That's a good question. I passed an Air Force. I didn't drive in Civvy Street before. I learned on it. On a 3-ton truck, actually, on an airfield. Where was it? I can't remember now quite.
Back in England, though?
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't.
Did you have trouble? Because trucks aren't easy to drive. Did you have trouble learning?
Declutching, yes, the double declutching. Oh, yes. I had a bit of trouble, but I usually tried to keep it in one or two gears. Didn't usually go through the whole box. I mean, you know, it was a question of we didn't have enough actual drivers on the unit, and some of us had to drive to keep the thing going. So, yes, I learned, and I was passed by my own transport sergeant. But unfortunately, when I was demobbed, it wasn't valid in Civvy Street. I had to go through the whole lot again trying to get a civilian license.
Now, anything else happened in this period while you were based, you're mainly based at Le Mans?
Well, no, I wasn't. That wasn't very long, actually.
Okay, what happened
then? But as I say, and then there was a time we moved into, while I did this convoy thing, we actually based in a small chateau in Algiers, just outside Algiers as a base, as a headquarters base. And it was... there again, it's difficult to analyze exactly because there were so many times when I was already well established in Italy, I had to go back to North Africa to do one or two special jobs and then go back again. And so to actually put it into chronological order, I find a bit difficult because we were moved about so much and in so many different ways that it's not easy.
And what about your food? Let's talk about something simple.
We used to live on mainly what's called compo rations. No. That was boxes, wooden boxes, filled with tins of meat and vegetable, various suet puddings, and you know, real meals. I think in each box there were meals for 7 people. And there were cigarettes and chocolate and sweets, and then chocolate as well. But very often you found you opened your box and those were gone. Somebody loading and unloading had pilfered them. So, you know, that was one of the things we found very irritating. But of course, the other thing is being senior NCOs, you got special rations actually. Especially spirit rations and that sort of thing, which, as I didn't drink, I managed to put to good use, making my life a bit more comfortable.
Like, in what way?
Getting a camp bed from the Americans, and for, I think it was one bottle of whiskey or something like that, you know. And even when I was aboard ship, I gave my rum ration away and I had my laundry done and God knows what, you know. So it helped. And those little items, as a matter of fact, we got, yeah, there were cigarettes in these compilations, I think, a tin of, I think it was 50 for each person per week, I think it was. Of course, I used to smoke a lot more than that in those days. I used to get a lot of packets of American cigarettes as well. But that, you know, by that time, as I said, I had a couple of attachments to the Americans, and that helped comfort-wise.
They'd give them, or you'd swap them for whiskey?
No. I was then entitled to use their PX facilities, you know, buy cartons of cigarettes and buy anything I liked, really.
How did you get on with the Americans?
On the whole, quite well. Sometime later in the interview, there's quite a bit about my attachments to various American units. And I got on quite well with them. Once I taught them not to flash their money about, that although we were paid less than they were, we managed, and I didn't need their charity sort of thing. I was very sensitive about that, because they had an idea that to make friends, you had to flash the bankroll, and I wasn't too enamored with that.
How did you get on with the local Arab civilians, or, you know, the
not very
Tunisian?
I didn't have much to do with them. I remember one instance where we were on the road, I forgot, from collecting rations or something, and there was a couple of Arabs standing on the side of the road holding up eggs, which they knew we liked fresh eggs, to barter. And I asked the driver to stop the truck, and I thought it would be nice to have a couple of fried eggs, you know, that sort of thing. And but I was watching, and this fellow was dealing with the eggs, and I looked in my mirror, the side of the truck, and saw somebody scrambling behind the truck. So I realized they were trying to nick our blankets and stuff out of the back of the truck. So we both got off the truck very smart, and we were both armed, actually, but two of them ran across the fields. We couldn't catch them, but one we managed to catch, and we just took them to the nearest village and handed them over to the local French gendarmes, and I know they'd deal with them all right, no problem.
So you didn't have much contact in a friendly way with them? I mean,
not at all, and in fact they were very anti, actually.
How did
they
it
were
show
more,
itself?
They were more concerned with helping the Germans. Well, I mean, another thing is, one night we were, that chateau I was talking about in Algiers, where we were based, we'd been several times this happened. I was in town, forgot we went to the RAF, the Malcolm Club, which is an RAF social club, to have a chat and a couple of drinks. And the end of the bus stop was about half a mile away from the chateau, so we had to walk that last half mile. We got off the bus, must have been about 11 o'clock at night or something, and we were walking along the road, but we were always aware of something, and I suddenly heard something behind me, and there was a couple of these local boys ready to pounce, you know, trying to, well, they'd strip you and take your guns and what have you, if they got this chance. But we had our Sten guns ready and cocked, and so we just swung round. And as soon as they saw us swinging around with guns and irons, they just went back into the bushes. You know, we didn't have to shoot or anything, but we would have had a very rough time if we hadn't been aware of what was liable to happen. It wasn't the only incident.
So they were basically a threat of stealing.
I mean, they used to come, for instance, some of our boys, I mean, the chateau, and some of us slept actually in the chateau on the top floor in the attic, but some of them were in the grounds. And I was actually, they creep into the tents at night, people asleep, and just nick anything they could lay their hands on. You know, I mean, it was terrible.